You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. This is being recorded late in the evening, May 14th, 2025. I was going to say something last week, but I didn't. I thought of not saying anything at all, but I realized that I have an obligation to say something. That last week, as many of you know, was the 80th anniversary of the end of World War II in Europe. Germany capitulated to Stalin and Roosevelt. I was going to talk about the Eurozone issue with Bulgaria and even the new alliances forming in the Balkans, which are deadly serious issues. Maybe I'll get to some of that. But I think it's important that I mention this. It's hard to argue with the idea that World War II was the most significant event, certainly the most significant event of the 20th century, and possibly a good chunk of the 19th, too. You know, post-Napoleon, World War II and the Bolshevik Revolution. World War II makes sense because of the Soviet Union was created. But in 1945, nothing on earth was ever the same again, especially in terms of political ideology. The truth is that nothing succeeds like a victory in a war, especially a major war. Your opponent, once he's vanquished, is almost subconsciously discredited ideologically by everybody. Once it suffers such a all-encompassing defeat as the Axis did in 1945, the worst aspect, at least immediately, of the end of the war was that the world was then divided between the Allied forces of the left, liberalism and Marxism, advanced capitalism and Leninism, which have, as you've heard me say many times, far more in common than they do in difference. Nationalism and traditionalist conservatism, royalism, that kind of thing, was relegated to the fringes of society. National socialism wasn't permitted to function again, except possibly in the Third World. I do want to note, though, that given official sponsorship, it didn't happen with Leninism after 1990, showing how artificially propped up that all was. But a historian can't help but ask, what would have been different? Most of the problems, and this was a big argument of Willis Cardo when I was working for him, the Barnes Review, that the problems we talk about every day, the issues we deal with every day, would not have come into existence had Hitler been a victor of World War II, which is almost an impossibility given how inferior Germany was in terms of industry and military capacity. I came across an article by James Miller, who I think is a National Socialist, and was part of a book called Immigration, Globalization, and Political Correctness, The Jewish Elite's Attack on the Western World. And here's what he says. In the final analysis, World War II was essentially a war between two competing ideologies, nationalism versus Jewish internationalism, globalism. Adolf Hitler and his allies fought to preserve the concept of nationalism not just for Germans, but for everyone the world over. Nationalism just means the sovereignty of an ethnic people and the right of such ethnic people or nationalists within their own bordered country to self-determination. What is meant by self-determination? Self-determination just means an ethnic, people preserving their unique culture and heritage and pursuing their collective goals as that unique people. Now, it's a nice summary. I mean, he defines self-determination and nationalism almost identically, but it's a valuable summary. That's a good summary also of what Hitler thought he was doing at the time. We live in an age of enforced ignorance and blind conformity. And the National Socialist idea, that's not a bad summary of it. There is no nation, though, without the ethnos. Nationalism is not intrinsically connected to the state or even a specific form of leadership. It predates a lot of that. It is the specific ethnic group, the ethnos. Those ties, biological, historical, religious, geographic, that hold them together. Without the ethnos, no society could function. In fact, no society could exist at all. National Socialism is not fascism. Now, I've read Mussolini at great length, and he infamously defines fascism as a nation being a product of the state, not its cause. In other words, the ethnos is an artificial creation of the state. And here's what he says in The Doctrine of Fascism. Insofar as it is embodied in the state, this higher personality becomes a nation. It is not the nation that generates the state. That is an antiquated, naturalistic concept which afforded a basis for 19th century publicity in favor of national governments. Rather, it is a state which creates the nation, conferring volition and therefore real life on a people made aware of their moral unity. Now, that's the complete reverse of what I would call nationalism, what I've been arguing is nationalism for many years. Certainly Hitler's idea. What Mussolini said is very much the liberal definition, that the ethnos is artificial. Maybe even the state too, but the ethnos is a creation of external things. That's the liberal definition, trying to delegitimize it. Now, Mussolini's doctrine can be interpreted in a bunch of different ways, but he's pretty clear. And he says this in many other places, an ethnic group can't exist without the state that brings it to life. Now, maybe in unifying Italy, which you can make an argument really is two different nations, North and South, maybe that helped speed up that idea. And when he refers to 19th century publicity or publicism, he's likely referring to people like Johann Herder in the Romantic movement, who theorized the dominance of the ethnos, an ethno-anarchism that Mussolini would never accept. What makes the 20s and 30s, the 20th century, 100 years ago, such an era of ferment, was that World War I had destroyed the best of European manhood for no clear reason. Second, the rise of the Soviet Union and its desire to take over the world by force, and among other things, liberal democratic capitalism was totally exposed as decrepit, oligarchic. It's a disease of capital and speculation. Now, there are many others, but those are the three that, you know, came to me. Hitler was immensely successful. The state form taken in Germany was a response to that world. Miller lists 18 things, specific things, that would have been different. Now, of course, there's probably thousands and thousands you could come up with. There's a massive number. I don't know if I'm going to go through all 18. Many of these you could probably just come off the top of your head. But there certainly wouldn't have been any USSR. Russia would have a much larger population, maybe 300 million. Same thing for Germany. Of course, no Cold War, no communist Eastern Europe. China would look very different, since you'd have 60 million more Chinese alive. There would have been no Vietnam War. There would have been no Korean War, no Castro. The slaughter of Cambodia would not have occurred. I mean, Marxism just simply wouldn't be a viable political ideology, and I don't think liberalism would be either. Or postmodern liberalism and multiculturalism wouldn't dominate the Western mind. Of course, you wouldn't have third world immigration into Western nations. The Jews would not have the power, nearly have the power that they have today. They wouldn't have been entirely neutralized, of course. But their mentality would have been exposed. It would have been mainstream to do that. You wouldn't have widespread pornography. Society would not be secular or materialist. Feminism would be relegated to a fringe theory for lunatics. Israel would exist. I disagree with Miller on this. Israel certainly would exist, although under very different circumstances. The endless wars of the Jews certainly would have been prevented. Chances are it may not have been in the Middle East, although Hitler thought that was a good idea. There were other options, maybe even Madagascar. Hitler thought of that as a possible Jewish homeland. But with the British out of the way, the Mideast was an actual viable option. That's a summary of the 18. But you're talking about 100 million human beings that would exist. But they'd be gone by now, of course, if that war never occurred. The global banking cartel would largely be a memory. This cartel sought war with Germany without mercy. World War II was fought to make the world safe for Stalin and his successors. But this was all worth it, we're told, in order to rescue Jews from a madman that wanted to conquer the world. But Leninism actually sought to conquer the world. The British Empire almost dominated the entire world, so it's just projection. Hitler would have settled the Jews in the Mideast. The British couldn't have done much about it. The Havana Agreement, 1933, Hitler did receive support from German Zionists here. There were a few thousand that were sent to the Middle East under the agreement, subsidized. In fact, I've seen the coins. They have the hexagram of Solomon, the so-called Star of David, on one side and the swastika on the other. Most of the anti-Jewish groups of the 19th century and very early 20th century, the Union of the Russian People included, wanted the transfer of Jews out of Europe. That's the only way to deal with the problem. So anti-Jewish thinking and Zionism, they had some common ground. Maybe they shouldn't have called it, we wouldn't have called it Israel, which is an insult to actual Israelites. But Zionism, it would have been a very different manifestation of it. The big difference would have been that Jews would not be in control over the foreign policies of the Western world. It's possible that whatever they created in the Middle East may not have been viable at all. I always laughed at the World War II vet. Unfortunately, they're not around anymore. Supporting the troops in Vietnam or Korea. None of them ever thought that, you know, they seem incapable of understanding the simple fact that Hitler's loss made Vietnam and Korea inevitable. When I was a professor for 22 years, I think, total, in a few different universities. And here's how I started. You know, I did a lot of 20th century stuff. And I've said this before, but here's how I began my lecture on World War II or Hitler or anything else in that category. I don't give any conception, you know, of who I'm talking about or the time period. I just say this. Consider a nation that has just lost 3 million of its best men in a horrifically bloody and needless war. Every family suffered at least one combat death or serious battlefield injury. The people living in a state of shock from the carnage that no one could have predicted at the time. The nation in question is bankrupt in all senses. It can't care for the millions of men mutilated by the war, let alone normal healthcare issues. The victors have demanded that this nation pay for the entire cost of the war. Today would be trillions of dollars. This nation has been blamed for the war, without equivocation, and propaganda to this effect floods the airwaves. Tremendously demoralizing this people. The peace treaty ending the war stipulated that any growth in its economy was to be confiscated. Food aid was denied to the country until the treaty was signed, as it was under a strict blockade and facing starvation. It was forced to pay all the war debts as well as the cost of the war. The state was in a permanent state of almost collapse. So tax collection was minimal and evasion was widespread. No real functional, no real modern economy because the victors of this war had dismantled most of the industry. The currency has become worthless, as the central bank is controlled by foreigners who run the currency into the ground. Unemployment runs anywhere from 40 to 60%. Riots and even shootings subsidized by foreign powers convulse the streets almost weekly, and law enforcement has lost all control. There is no faith in political institutions, since they're permitted to function only so long as they enforce the treaty. The legislature is ineffective and deeply divided, run by parties that are hardly representative of the population. Close by, there's a massive empire, many times the size of this defeated nation, that loudly proclaims it will destroy the defeated entity. In fact, some of these external enemies have already occupied strategic parts of the country. Other regions seem on the brink of falling as well. The country's been physically divided. Huge numbers of its former citizens are now forced to live under hostile and foreign rulers. Something like 80,000 square miles. 8 million of her people forced to live within neighboring states that have been told to hate them. Economically important parts of the country have been occupied, their resources taken. Anything of value has been removed, and the country's enemies have made it clear that in order for it not to be a threat again, it will be turned into a pastoral economy used for labor and whatever natural resources it still possesses. The treaty stipulates a minimal army, navy, and air force at the absolute minimum, rendering the country defenseless. The country is ruled by a small oligarchy that live lavishly, controlling its remaining wealth in exchange for enforcing the treaty that holds the nation in bondage. Morality, social trust, this has collapsed. Traditional culture has been attacked, replaced by vulgarity in the nation's cities, which few citizens had ever experienced before. The world's first sexual revolution was launched by this nation's internal enemies. Even now, the family is collapsing. The media is dominated by a tiny handful of families hostile to the country. The culture, the religion, has been mocked and reduced to nothing, something of little value. Civic virtue has collapsed. Few have any hope for the future. Life expectancy continually falls. And keep in mind, too, that this population is very much aware that just a few years ago, they were a feared powerhouse both economically and militarily, with a scientific establishment considered to be the best in the world. Okay, you've just been elected to run this country. What do you do? Now, I've seen brains break, if you're even allowed to, you know, talk this much, trying to answer the question. A lot of undergraduates don't know I'm talking about Germany after World War I. And certainly after the start of the Great Depression. Try to say all of this to a normie. See what happens. The Versailles Treaty said all the above and more. But in uttering this, students see Hitler not as a comic book bad guy, but as a very desperate man who sought all the power he could to wrest his nation away from these vultures. Today, I don't think anyone in the universe thinks that the Versailles Treaty was legitimate. But at the time, it was seen as progressive. It did have opponents, though. What Hitler was able to do in a very short time was nothing short of a miracle. And many foreign leaders said the same. You know, when I was a professor, I approached this very differently than my colleagues. And to try to understand any leader or any ideology, the historian has to understand them as they understood themselves. History is the analysis of context. That introduction I just read to you, that I wrote, that's the context. Contemporary ideological fads or media-generated issues can't be read back onto these events. That's the opposite of scholarship. That's vulgar journalism. But today, the only purpose for universities under the present post-war regime is a justification of leftist and globalist doctrine. I've talked about this to professors many times. They've never considered Hitler in this context. Love him or hate him, I would say, he pulled off the impossible. In a few years, Hitler helped transform this disaster into one of the most prosperous, unified, energetic, culturally significant, and militarily feared nations in the world. I don't care how much you might hate the guy, you can't deny it. Western banks and Wall Street had nothing to do with this. They loathed, at least when Hitler came to power. First of all, you weren't really allowed to invest in Germany. All of these Wall Street barons were screaming for war by the late 30s. As much as I love Anthony Sutton, he was deadly wrong in that book. It wasn't as direct as his work on the Soviet Union. But when I was a professor, my lectures were objective. My goal was scholarship, to understand an ideology, a philosophical school, or a historical event, the way the actors themselves understood it, not in accordance with modern ideological trends or ethnic demands. I have never used editorial rhetoric in my classes, unlike almost all my colleagues, some of whom, many of whom, treat the classroom as their own re-education camp. But this was my great sin. One time I lost a job, and I'll never forget the line, "We don't deny his great ability. We just don't like where these questions are leading." That's a very close paraphrase by the department chair. I've heard variations of this. They look at my student evaluations. Students love this guy. But all of this is in service of social sciences and humanities, where students are not educated. They're indoctrinated. White males are second-class citizens on any college campus, so they're not going. Universities are based on false advertising. But since education doesn't refer to an object, like a manufactured thing, like an automobile, a university can't be sued for providing it poorly. Another line that was given to me by a university, it wasn't department chair, it was someone in the administration. This was in writing, although unfortunately I don't have it anymore. It's got to be on file somewhere, though. This is what was said. "Asking why Hitler didn't use poison gas to fight the Soviets once the war was lost isn't scholarship worthy of the name here at this university." Of course, everything came down to Hitler and the Jews. And none of these people ever seemed to notice why. Why is it just this one group of people? Everything else, I was given tremendous freedom, except with this one group of people. Hitler's ideology has been entirely invented by this same class of tenured frauds. Any invention is acceptable. It's not as bad as it used to be, like the lampshade stuff. Everyone knows that that's false. But it took a long time for that nonsense to be refuted. But opposition to this fantasy is met with threats of violence and employment termination. In Europe, prison sentences. It cost me an academic career, but after 2020, it couldn't have happened. Thanks to my listeners, thanks to you guys, I'm able to do this. And I have a lot more freedom, and I can live with myself. But they can froth at the mouth all they want. The facts remain stubborn. My conscience is clear. I should note that the department chair who uttered what I said above resigned that very semester. The student newspaper immediately said it was because of firing Dr. J, right? It's funny because that university had to go on record denying this. So widespread was the idea. These are all connected, and this past 80 years has led to utter degeneration and corruption that's taken as normal. Now, for the second half of this, I want to talk about what I was going to talk about, something that, again, would never have existed. We're talking about the European Union, the Eurozone, the attack on nations, especially after 1990, and specifically Bulgaria. Now, Bulgaria, we talked about Romania, Moldova, Serbia. Now, Bulgaria. It's a lot of the same things. You have well-educated, strongly patriotic populations who have been reduced to third-world status. They were second world, meaning they came from the Soviet experience. First world, of course, is Western. Third world is everybody else. But Bulgaria has, its very corrupt leadership has sought to join the Eurozone. Now, I've said this many times before. This is an article from Silvia Rosieva. It came out May 11th of 2025. And she's also noticed something. I don't hear this a lot, but that official statistics in Europe and the U.S. are usually fudged. They're usually false. and it's getting worse. Besides that, of course, the majority of Bulgarians want to keep their national currency. There's been some protests. Bulgarians have stormed the EU offices there in Sofia. But we all know that that doesn't mean a damn thing. Bulgaria has been famously known for being pro-Russian. The media is entirely controlled by the West or the state, only permits the NATO point of view. So maybe this is changing. It's a tragedy because you had a tremendous population that now is reproducing itself at the lowest level in all of Europe, which is saying something. But how do you get into the Eurozone? It's funny that most of the European states that are in it today, if they had to rejoin it, couldn't. You know, price stability, sustainable interest rates, sustainable public finances, and exchange rates. You can't have an inflation rate observed over a period of a year of no more than 1.5 percentage points above the rate of the three best performing member states. The government deficit should not exceed 3% of GDP. And the government debt ratio should not be higher than 60% of GDP. Now, the Bulgarian lev has been tied to the euro for some time. And that's kind of your first step. EU membership has been an absolute disaster for Bulgaria and much of the Second World. Poland is somewhat of an exception because it was largely colonized by German companies. But now that's completely irrelevant. Currency can fluctuate within, I think, a standard limit of 15% above or below that agreed central exchange rate from the Commission. So adopting the euro involves permanently fixing the exchange rate between the national currency and the euro, and then transferring responsibility for monetary policy to the European Central Bank. So in terms of monetary policy, finance, and fiscal issues, the country is no longer independent. You have a very close coordination in budgetary policies, a responsibility of a nation in the Eurozone. And every year in October, Eurozone members have to submit their draft budgetary plan for the following year to the Commission. So you can't come up with your own budget anymore. Sanctions will be imposed on anyone not capable of doing this. So in 2024, the acting government there simply fudged the numbers. For example, government agencies postponed payments for like social and other programs until after December. In other words, transferring 2024 obligations to 2025, right? And that's how things like the budget deficit were appeared normal, because the money hadn't been spent yet. So if you were the caretaker of someone disabled or, you know, you had to wait for the year, thus preserving the country's eligibility for Eurozone accession. But of course, like all EU states, Bulgaria is drowning in debt. Both the European Union and the European Central Bank, it's a profoundly corrupt institution. I've never gotten into this before, but most of you know who Christine Lagarde is. One of the heads of the IMF, now European Central Bank. She was educated in the U.S. She has a criminal record when she was finance minister in France. 2016, she was convicted of, quote, negligence for her role in defrauding French taxpayers of about 400 million euros, serving in that capacity. She was convicted in her role, controversial payment to a scam businessman. The French judges found Lagarde guilty of negligence for failing to challenge the state arbitration payout to someone who was a friend of the former French president, Nicolas Sarkozy, a guy named Bernard Tapie, who died in 2021. It's somewhat of a complicated issue. Tapie owned Adidas. Tapie had been, he was in line to be the finance minister under Mitterrand in France. And so he had to sell some of this stuff. The panel upheld the Tapie's claim initially was that the bank, state bank, Credit Lyonnais, had defrauded him by intentionally undervaluing Adidas at the time the sale, and that the state, because that was the bank's principal shareholder, should compensate him. Lagarde, who in her role as French finance minister, ordered the case to be heard by an arbitration panel, not through the court system. In other words, she had Tapie receive preferential treatment so that Tapie would support Sarkozy during his 2007 presidential bid. Let me put it this way. Paris court told Tapie to pay back the $404 million as it overturned his initial claim. It wasn't true. They didn't deliberately devalue his company when they sold it. So he had to pay back the money he got in damages. So he accused the bank of duping him into selling the sportswear firm for less than it's worth. He won a lot of money. This is back in 2005, 2006, but it was all overturned. In fact, two decisions were overturned. Not only were they overturned, but he was now under suspicion of fraud. The head of the IMF, the former French finance minister, Christine Lagarde, was a key witness in the case. Her decision to use arbitration to settle these things ended with him receiving the 2007 payout. Again, he claimed the state-owned bank had defrauded him by deliberately undervaluing the firm. Again, all of this was overturned. By the time of her conviction in this, Lagarde had moved on. Her criminal record has had nothing to do with her career. She gets rewarded for her crimes. She became managing director of the International Monetary Fund. We all know what they do. It didn't affect Lagarde's employment whatsoever. In fact, it solidified it. Not only that, but when she was found guilty, she didn't receive any punishment. Normally, that crime, negligence, rather than, you know, he should have been worse than that, but there's usually a year in prison and 16,000 euro fine at a minimum. She was rewarded for her acts, not penalized. So she was appointed to lead the IMF from 2011 to 2019, and now the European Central Bank. Her time at the IMF has been an utter disaster, but because she was the first female to head these things, she could do no wrong. The level of corruption was multi-layered. Funny thing is, the IMF Executive Board was chaired by the managing director, which was Lagarde herself. This is the body that expressed her full confidence in her ability. So the French judges refused to impose any sentence on her, pursuant to a decision of the executive board, which was routinely chaired by her. Some of you may remember the Dominique Strauss-Kahn case. That's what put her in the IMF. Strauss-Kahn was a nasty SOB. He was head of the IMF in 2011. Sexual assault charges, everything else. Now, there was no evidence for that. The charge was aggravated pimping, which I didn't know. I thought they were kidding. But it's an actual thing. Because he acknowledged attending all kinds of orgies. But there was no evidence that he knew any of the women there were prostitutes. Or underage, for that matter. So he had to resign, despite the fact that there was no evidence, or minimal, I mean, he's a scumbag. This is very typical. You know, Lagarde in her younger years did the exact same kind of thing. There was an American case against him, too. That was all thrown out. But had they released that information, Lagarde would never have been chosen to replace Strauss-Kahn. So she was confirmed as managing director in June of 2016. The report from the prosecutor saying that we're dropping the case was released on June 29th, 2016. It was confirmed on the 26th. They waited until the 29th to release the fact that the guy was innocent. So that's how she got the job. This is a next level affirmative action thing. So if it had been released a few days earlier, Lagarde's candidacy would have no doubt been questioned. This is their own version of regime change. It was implemented at the IMF in preparation for the French presidential elections. If you use Google, to talk about Christine Lagarde. One of my favorite articles, the BBC calls her a rock star head of the IMF. I mean, worshipful. Just remember back in 92 how the media treated Hillary Clinton. This is a woman who presided over the dismantling of the Greek economy, partially because she was part of the Eurozone. It was part of the Eurozone. Along with the EU, the IMF provided billions in emergency funds to help Greece service the debt, but also with draconian austerity measures that they had to implement because they were part of the Eurozone. Predatory privatization, just like Russia in the 90s. This is the same woman who's going to be approving Bulgaria's Eurozone membership. So it's not just, it's personal corruption, it's institutional corruption, it's ideological corruption. Now, the only reason that any of this matters, the only reason that Bulgaria's in the EU at all, or even being considered for the Eurozone, is not because she has any right to be there. Bulgaria doesn't meet these criteria, any of these criteria. It's because she's a pro-Russian population. Grabbing her, bringing her into the EU and the Eurozone is a way to keep her away from Russia. A decade ago, I talked about this issue. Bulgaria has been struggling for a very long time. I think it was 2013 I wrote on this, that when you peg the lev to the euro, the Bulgarian economy was very distorted because the European Union is unstable. I wrote this in 2013. I had no idea what was coming in 2020, and then the wars and the sanctions and everything else. If it was unstable then, none of the Eurozone members could ever actually join it if they weren't members already. Low economic growth, but Bulgarians are well-educated. Products fashioned by former Soviet states really don't have any markets in the West. Maybe there's interest in the East. It used to be oriented to the Russian market. China was always very interested in Bulgaria. It's normally a good sign. But she was rapidly brought into the EU, breaking all the rules, shoved aside so as to get Sofia into the union as quickly as possible. Bulgaria has a certain amount of oil. Oil and her longstanding alliance with Moscow, the two big reasons the EU had to bring Bulgaria into its thraldom. So as energy prices rose, Bulgaria's fragile economy went into a sharp decline. She was admitted to the EU as a countermeasure for any joining of SCO or anything else. In other words, she was guaranteed international respectability by EU membership in exchange for her sovereignty, her oil, her natural gas, and her government's domestic popularity. The EU has brought nothing to Bulgaria. And given her energy policy, membership it's impoverished the country. In other words, Bulgaria has been forced to export all of her domestic resources. It's a carnival inversion of reality that international capitalism has created through this. Now it has to import oil, since EU demands that it be routed to them. Bulgaria had no control over its own resources. So a country that could have serviced itself in terms of oil now actually had to import it. Then the Bulgarian government began investing in nuclear power to compensate for the oil that was taken forcibly from the country. Now, that had to be dismantled because of environmental concerns. And this was sold domestically. This was progress. This was democratization. Back in 2022, Bulgarian Prime Minister Kirill Petkov lost a no-confidence vote. Very few of these governments have any support in the population. There's a lot of parties, and governments are put together with 20% of the popular vote. There's a very low turnout rates for their elections. Kirill Petkov went to Harvard. He's actually a Canadian citizen. And he was told to say any critics of his were Russian agents, beholden to organized crime, which is just projection. Now, this was the first time that you had a no-confidence vote in Bulgaria. A small number of MPs actually supported the prime minister. Now, the main opposition party is Revival. Of course, he just said the same things over and over again. This is a conduit for Russian interests. President Ruman Radev now had three attempts to create a government, but if all of them fails, he has to dissolve the parliament and call a new general election, which happens all the time now, the fourth since April 2021. The no confidence vote came from several defections from his ruling coalition over budget concerns and the government's willingness to support North Macedonia's bid to join the EU, not to mention endless economic hardship. Petkov's anti-Russian stance led to Bulgaria being cut off from 90% of its natural gas supplies. Worse, he fired his defense minister, Stefan Yaniev, 3 years ago, accusing him of promoting Russian narratives. Because he only would call the conflict in Ukraine a military operation, not a war. But back to 2025, the numbers were fudged to get, you know, the budget deficit to get to 3%, as I mentioned already. They tried to make believe that they could meet the price stability criterion by proving that inflation didn't exceed 2.53%, given the criteria I've mentioned already. But to do this, they used the Harmonized Index of Consumer Prices, which is the Consumer Price Index, for the previous 12 months. So from June 2024 to this month, May of 2025. Official statistics, as always, is meant to cover up the real numbers. They claim that the average annual inflation rate in Bulgaria stood at 2.5%. So it's in perfect harmony with what the ECB demands for its price stability criterion. Of course, it's a complete and total lie. Everyone knows that the inflation statistic in America is a lie. Prices have been skyrocketing at least for the last 15 years. And it's only been in the last few years that the media decided to mention it. So Americans could see prices go through the roof and not say a thing. So food and non-alcoholic beverages went up 4% in 1 year, this very same period of time. Actually, beverages just by themselves went up by 7%. So the 4% inflation or 2.5% is utter nonsense. Hotel, restaurant, food, you know, went up by 4% in just a few months. But they also claimed that air travel prices went down by 14.3%. Have you ever seen airline prices go down anywhere like that in the last 20 years? And yet, bread prices on January 1st of this year rose by 20% because of a tax increase. Of course, there's no price stability there. There's no 2.5% inflation rate. They're already on the verge of third world status. They're barely hanging on to second world status. Being in the EU has been an utter disaster. If you add the Eurozone, it's going to get far worse. It's happened in every single country that's ever entered the Eurozone. And this is before COVID. Or actually, this is before 2008. This is before COVID. This is before the sanctions that gutted the German economy. Prices in Bulgaria have been exploding, especially when you consider the average income. But most people who are in the know in Bulgaria know that this is their numbers are a lie. I think they say their unemployment rate is 4.5%. Another lie. Their big statistics agency, Eurostat, says that the economic fragility of the Bulgarian population, there's a measure of economic fragility. And they say that 30% of Bulgarians are, quote, at risk of poverty and social exclusion. Now, the true number is probably half. That's not just a matter of risk, that's reality. Entering the Eurozone is just going to drive prices higher. It's going to starve large portions of the population. And when they impose austerity, once they realize just how high the debt and deficit really are, you're not going to have those social programs anymore. Actually 2 years ago, 2023, Revival, the only real opposition party, gathered, I think, 1 million signatures to get a referendum about the adoption of the euro. And it didn't happen. They even tried to go to the Constitutional Court, which is just as politicized as any other court. And they said any referendum would be unconstitutional because it has to do with an international treaty. So even before they join the Eurozone, they've lost all rights to their... Because they know, you know, unless massive rigging takes place, they're going to want their own currency. But if they want their own currency, then they need to get out of the EU. Big protests starting in February have occurred in Sofia, defending their own currency. Of course, both of the major ruling parties have condemned it. Mainstream media, European Commission, with no exception, using the same language. What the European Union and their own government started doing is collecting personal information of protesters as they were on their way home. Some people threw some red paint on the building of the European Commission there, and that was their excuse to arrest them. Now what's happened is that the current government has embarked on what they call a taxpayer-funded information communication campaign. That's just just propaganda. Now in full force to convince the electorate that adopting the euro is part of their euro integration and how it's a wonderful thing and how wonderful it will be for them. At this point, dissent here, like elsewhere in Central Europe, it will lead to a prison term. I've been writing about this phenomenon in many different places. Like, for example, I wrote back in 2013, after the meltdown of Bulgaria of 2008, Bulgaria was hit very hard. Boyko Borisov was head of government there at the time, and the IMF forced a finance minister on them, Yankov, more hated even than Borisov himself. He was just a bureaucrat at the World Bank. His faction came to power only in 2007, with electoral turnout of 27%. Another election 2 years later, his faction came to power again with a grand total of 38% of the popular vote. Only a handful of Bulgarians ever bothered to vote. This is, of course, perfectly acceptable. The media is owned by westernized businesses, and they only showed speeches of Borisov and his friends during the elections. Organized crime, which is completely Jewish, ensured his electoral victory with the full blessing of the U.S. and the EU. The party was called the Citizens for European Development of Bulgaria. They poll consistently when they were around with the approval rating between 11 and 15%. Somehow, though, consistently through all this, they got 50% of the vote. Of course, which is a travesty. Back then, with David Cameron, Angela Merkel, Obama, everyone was supporting them. And in public, their public stance is nationalist, but their public policies, of course, are just the opposite. So they lie to the... I guess no one bought it. But there's been no government there that's had more than a 10%, 12% approval rating in a very, very long time. It was in 2013 that Borisov had to resign. I mentioned high energy prices. Well, that's strange. In a country that has oil, wouldn't you think that high energy prices would be beneficial? Well, not when they're in the EU. They had no control over that energy anymore. Borisov was just treated as a tool of organized crime, as is the current government. There's an image of him running to a plane in his pajamas. So in Parliament, his faction still gets control of the legislative process, while rarely getting more than 35%, despite the fact that they have this ridiculous popularity rating. I mean, this is part of how Bulgaria got there. Media control, prison for dissidents. Using any crisis to push their people. Endless propaganda campaigns. You had a disaster. I mean, the Eurozone itself. I mean, there are constant bank runs. Bond markets panic. The southern governments, along the southern perimeter in Europe, need bailouts every few years. Unemployment has skyrocketed, despite official statistics. European Central Bank continues to print money. It's been a financial disaster in every way. That was before COVID and the Ukraine war. But that was written in 2016. Well, the information came from 2016. So that was before these massive shocks to the economy. I mentioned the Eurostat category of people at risk of poverty or social exclusion from Eurostat. This is how you know that there's no way that official statistics can be correct. There's no way these governments could be getting any more than 10 or 15% of the vote. In Greece, it was almost 40% of the population fell into that category just a few years ago. Cyprus was almost 30%. Spain, Italy, even Luxembourg, almost 20%. And it's become a lot worse since those statistics are a few years old. So at risk of poverty is defined as living on less than 60% of the national median income, which itself has crashed over the last few years. No one has recovered from the 2008 crash, COVID, or, of course, the sanctions. In Greece, the median income has dropped from, I think, 10,800 euros yearly to 7,500. They're all crashing. And any statistic who says otherwise is simply lying. There's no foundation for it. And they keep bringing in more migrants. It's like 10%. According to their own statistics, 8% of the people within the Eurozone are severely materially deprived. That means they lack access to basic necessities. So in places, Greece, Italy and Spain, those numbers are going through the roof. In Cyprus, prior to COVID, it was up by more than 50%. They said that they were going to destroy poverty by 2020. So given any economic crisis, those are built into the nature of postmodern capitalism. After these countries go bankrupt, they had to be bailed out. So the EU, along with the ECB and the IMF, imposed these austerity packages that slash welfare systems, cut pensions, and buy up anything that isn't nailed down. That's how this functions. It's more than just losing currency sovereignty or having to turn over your budget to the EU. This is a highly unstable and impoverished society that keeps bringing in migrants. That's a reserve army to use against a nationalist revolution. This is why guys are being sent to prison in France, in Moldova, in Romania for questioning the system, and in Bulgaria too. Bulgaria is just an example. An obnoxious one. In other words, these are all countries that, if they were run normally, would be very prosperous today. And Adolf Hitler would have won in World War II, they would be very prosperous today, assuming that his system would have continued, which I can't assume. Evil's everywhere. But let's just say, at least it would have been a mainstream option. Now, of course, that system, National Socialism, is out of the question. Economically speaking. Anyway, thank you for bearing with me through all of this. This is just more, fraud that's been forced on many innocent people throughout Europe. Using some of these countries as examples just makes it even more depressing. And it's no different here in the U.S. Thank you, everyone, again, for listening. I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.